Hello, everyone. This is The Takeaway. I'm Amy Walter. And we start today, where else, with Russia.
I'm not surprised we're starting with Russia.
Dan Coats gets it. The director of national intelligence spoke late this week with Andrea Mitchell at the Aspen Security Forum, which is pretty much Coachella for national security types. The conversation centered around the aftermath of Helsinki. After a week when President Trump sided with Russian Vladimir Putin over his own intelligence agencies, then walked back his own walk back, the American people are left wondering if the president truly believes his intelligence, that Russia interfered in the election, and if he does, why not say it? And if he doesn't, why not? And with another election coming up, Dan Coats, the DNI director, has been unequivocal.
It's undeniable that the Russians are taking the lead on this. We need to call them out on that.
He also expressed concern that Trump met with Putin one-on-one, and then Andrea Mitchell delivered some breaking news.
The White House has announced on Twitter that Vladimir Putin is coming to the White House in the fall.
Say that again? Okay.
Yeah.
That's going to be special.
As an intelligence officer, Coates says it's not his job to get political. His job is to assess the intelligence, communicate that to the president, and when necessary, to signal the alarms. And this, he says, is one of those times.
It was in the months prior to September 2001 when, according to then CIA Director George Tenet, the system was blinking red. And here we are nearly two decades later, and I'm here to say the warning lights are blinking red again.
The warning lights are blinking red. With us now is Michael Hayden, director of the NSA between 1999 and 2005, director of the CIA between 2006 and 2009, and now the principal of the Chertoff Group. And Chris Painter is the U.S.'s former top cyber diplomat, and he's currently the head of the Global Commission on the Stability of Cyberspace.
We've had this major event, this huge event, where there was an attack on the very foundation of our democracy. If there's no consequences for those bad actions, if there's nothing that actually serves to deter them, it becomes costless for them to do it again. And there's no reason for Putin not to do this again because there's been no cost that he's paid. And we haven't been good at imposing any either timely or credible costs on Putin or any threat of them in the future. And that's, I think, a real problem. And I think no matter how good the rest of the administration is, no matter how good people are at imposing sanctions or taking actions, if the precedent is not firm, if the president is not consistent in messaging saying this is unacceptable, that's a huge problem because it undercuts it. And we don't even have a declaratory statement. We don't even have a statement from the president saying this is impermissible, do it again, and we're going to take action. That's not even there. I mean, that's a foundation that you need to have.
So you do think that's important because what Republicans in Congress say is, look, we're doing our job as the check here. We have imposed sanctions. We're even talking about another bill to impose more sanctions should they meddle. But what you're saying is Congress can do all they want, but if the president doesn't back that up, then it's not really a serious deterrent?
Yeah, it's great that they're doing that. It's great that even the administration has imposed some sanctions. But put yourself in Putin's shoes, if you will, for a moment. If you're looking at this and you say, okay, there have been some sanctions, not that bad, really. I can deal with those. You know, I've been invited by Trump back to the G8, for instance. That really undercuts all those messages and, again, doesn't have the forceful approach that you need. When President Obama was dealing with China on the theft of intellectual property, which is a big deal if you remember a couple of years ago, it's still a big problem, but it was a huge deal back then. There was consistent high-level messaging over the course of almost 2 years from not just the president but every cabinet official that this was inappropriate and something that was bigger than cyber, that really was something that was a hit in the overall relationship, and that helped change behavior, at least get an agreement to change behavior. We don't see that here.
General Hayden, the DNI director, Dan Coats, talked about this blinking red light when it comes to cybersecurity. What does that mean to you when the DNI director says this is a blinking red light?
Well, I very much appreciate that Director Coats is going out there and laying some things clearly out for the American people and pretty much doing it as an independent, and I mean that in a very positive way for the administration. I think Director Coats was trying to make sure everyone understood that he and the intelligence community took very seriously the broader cyber threat. But then again, he did hone in on what the Russians were doing and the potential for election interference and so on. So absent what Chris correctly points out, absent presidential messaging on this, he went out there and put a clear marker down. And I was struck at Aspen when I asked, why did he on Monday then issue a statement about Russian interference? He said to correct the public record, which is a remarkable thing for someone within an administration to say. And Amy, can I add one thing to what Chris said earlier? In addition to the very important strategic concerns he laid out with regard to consistent messaging, there's an operational problem here. What happened with regard to the Russians in 2016, I've taken to describe as kind of an unexpected danger against a previously unappreciated weakness. In effect, it hit a seam between federal and local policy and politics, intelligence and law enforcement, and so on. And then the lesson from that, a little bit like 9/11, and believe me, I know all the differences, but you have got to go extraordinary to respond because ordinary didn't work. And we only go extraordinary structures, law, policy, resources, people, when the president directs that. And what we've got now is everyone really trying hard, but Amy, they're playing position. And they were playing position in 2016. And that won't work.
Yeah, I can say, you know, as part of the cyber community then in the government and even afterwards in the beginning of the Trump administration, this is not a threat we saw coming. We were focused on the traditional fear of an attack on critical infrastructure that could take out lights or power or financial systems. We're worried about theft of intellectual property. But for whatever reason, because this is not just a cyber issue, this is an influence operation.
Right.
The cyber folks just weren't focused on this as a major threat. And it really goes to what Mike said. This is in between the themes that you really need to have a concerted approach. It's not just cyber people, but really almost a task force to look at this. And I still really haven't seen that set up. I was happy to see Rod Rosenstein announce this idea that Justice is going to start, or the FBI is going to start contacting victims when they see evidence of nation state subversion of democratic processes. That's great, but that's only one step. We don't have that coordinated approach. We don't have a coordinated approach from the White House, from the National Security Council. There's no one who's really tasked to do this yet.
So how much of the issue for both of you, how much of this is political? I mean, we saw in 2016 the White House, then President Obama's White House, struggling with how do we talk about this in a way that's not going to look like I'm tipping the election for one or the other? Should we have been harder? Should we have been softer? Obviously, President Trump said this is Obama's fault. He knew about it and didn't do anything about it. So is this about political will, or is this really about putting the structures in place within the government to make sure this doesn't happen again?
I think it's both. I certainly don't think that in the Obama administration enough was done. I think it was treated too much of a political issue because they didn't want to affect the election. I can understand that, but you shouldn't ever let politics come into this. They should have taken action because this is such a threat to our democracy. It should have been a lot of the actions that were taken in December should have been done almost right away. You know, I used to say that cyber, for the many years I've done it, and I'm sure Mike will agree, was not really a political issue. It was really a bipartisan issue, and largely I think it still is, but this has colored it in a political way, which I think is really unhelpful. We should try to divorce this, and it's very difficult, from the political concerns, because they're attacking our democracy. It could be one side today, it could be another side tomorrow, and structures are important to be sure, but we also have to have the political will, not just in terms of election interference, but really in cyber across the board, and I just don't think senior decision makers completely get cyber yet or understand the threat.
And Chris, I want to ask you specifically about that topic of cyber, which is at least I hear it. You hear about cyber attacks and you think, okay, this is about going in and hacking our voter database or changing the results of an election. But what's more dangerous, that kind of hacking or just going on the internet and spreading false information and having bots tweet things out, which isn't really hacking, but it's the influence and the ability to divide and sow discord. Is that more dangerous than the possibility of the Russians coming in and going into a Secretary of State's office and messing with voter files?
Look, I think both of them are very dangerous. And I think you also have other cyber threats too that we have been worried about, like attacks on infrastructure that will have a more catastrophic catastrophic effect. So I think they're both of great concern. The kind of influence operation, the trying to get people to change their minds, that really isn't a pure cyber thing. And that's why you need a more holistic approach to deal with it. And indeed, one of the problems we have now is people drink their news through straws. They all are in their own camps. They look at just the things that they know and reinforces them. And it's really too easy to influence people. Influence operations, Mike can speak better to this than I, have been around forever and ever. However, you know, this has allowed people to do it at scale and target in a way that we haven't seen before. And that really requires a different approach than just the pure cyber approach.
Yeah, Amy, Chris brings up a really interesting thing from my own personal history. More than 20 years ago, I first encountered this whole cyber question when I took command of a big Air Force unit in Texas. And we were on kind of on the cutting edge thinking about things cyber when it comes to the armed forces. Cyber is a domain. We're going to operate in the domain and so on. And we had a deep theological discussion that looked like a Jesuits at a medieval university or something as to whether we were in the cyber winning business or the information winning business, with cyber kind of being a subset of information, which was influence operations and deceptions and all the things that Chris has suggested. And we actually looked at that long and hard, and we finally decided, number one, cyber was tough enough, and number two, that information thing in American political culture quickly began to pull in amendments to the U.S. Constitution, like the First and the Fourth and so on. And so we stayed with cyber dominance, and that's why we now have a cyber command, not an information command. The Russians went to door number two. The Russians went to the information dominance lane, and now we're having trouble dealing with it because doctrinally we have not thought about this in that way.
What do you think's going on within the intelligence community? How do you think they're feeling about this, sort of the rank and file, as they're watching the president and members of the intelligence community publicly disagree on how to handle this?
Look, I've tried to write about this a lot, and I've tried to be very fair. We have a president who is very comfortable with his own intuition, with his own instinct. And Amy, I just have to say that very often it appears to me that the departure point for the president's actions or the president's words, the departure point is not an agreed upon view of objective reality, but of something different. That is the fundamental, almost existential issue between a president who functions in one way and an intelligence community that's designed to do something quite different.
I think you also, when you couple that with a lack of preparation, it also creates other issues. So when President Putin offered this idea of using our mutual legal assistance treaty to perhaps have Mueller come over and interview those people, which would have been really a stage show. But then to link it with interviewing our ambassador, Mike McFaul, was just something that everyone should have known is a complete non-starter from the beginning. And anyone from the law enforcement community or the national security community could have said that right off. But to call it a remarkable offer, really, I think, and then have 3 days pass before it was completely rejected, I think just shows it's also lack of understanding and preparation coupled with what Mike said.
Chris Painter, General Michael Hayden, thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What can Congress do, if anything, to address Russian hacking, protecting the Mueller probe, and providing a check on the president? And is there the will? David Drucker is a senior political correspondent for the Washington Examiner and a CNN political analyst. David, thanks for joining us.
Really good to be here. Thank you.
So, Dave, I feel like we've been here before, maybe once or twice or 250 times. The president does or says something that Republicans in Congress are upset about. They say, we don't like this. They issue press releases. And then nothing really happens. Are we kind of at that same place now?
Well, in one sense, yes. And in one sense, not exactly. I think what a lot of Americans that oppose President Trump and are worried about what he's doing domestically and internationally don't understand when they ask Republicans in Congress who are critical of him to do something.
That right, you got to do something.
You know, coming out of the Helsinki News Conference, I mean, the biggest thing I saw on Twitter, which I actually think is a useful tool, was progressives and just concerned Democrats saying, yeah, that's a nice statement of opposition, now do something. But one of the reasons Republicans, with the levers of power in Congress and even others, have been reluctant to do something is because most of their own voters don't want them to. Most of their own voters are pleased with President Trump, and even if they're not at times, they decide that it's a part of the package and a part of the bargain, and they don't want to throw him overboard to empower the left. And so you have these Republicans that came from the Reagan school of Republicanism. They're caught between their voters, who have decided they like Trump, and a president that they are very concerned about because of their own philosophical underpinnings. And so I think that leaves us with, you know, where are they? They're not going to do all that much, but they actually at times, especially on matters of foreign policy, have done, I think, more than people realize. A year ago in July 2017, there was a veto-proof majority for a bill that would not have happened, obviously, without Republicans, to constrain the kind of deal that President Trump can cut with Russia and Vladimir Putin without congressional approval. That was a rather historic rebuke of a president's foreign policy powers, which I wrote about at the time. And particularly on matters of foreign policy, what they're just not going to do is get together en masse and not just rebuke the president verbally, but then start to pass all sorts of legislation with Democrats that basically neuters him.
Right. I mean, we've seen the most vocal voices from the Republican side are either people that are retiring, or in another case, we have Representative Will Hurd from Texas. He wrote an op-ed in the New York Times basically saying that Putin has Trump under his spell, like that he is compromised in some way. So are you saying that that's it? Like, we're not going to hear anybody else come and make those kinds of pronouncements in the on the Republican side?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I spent a couple days in Richmond and I was interviewing the Democratic nominee against Representative Dave Brat in the Richmond suburbs, Sarah Kanner's old seat. She's a former clandestine officer in the CIA. And I said, do you agree with Democrats who say that the president has committed treason, or that the Russians have compromat on him, have compromising information? And she told me she didn't find that discussion helpful because it obscures from focusing on what Russia did and the fact that it has to be stopped. She went on at length about how repulsed she was and how dismayed she was at what she saw from the president. But there are differing opinions about why the president is doing what he's doing and how useful it is to focus on that. I will say, though, that you bring up, look, you get us back to that point of who is the strongest verbal critic of the president, willing to go the farthest on policy. If you're a Republican in a battleground district, Will Hurd's Texas district has always been a tough sell for a Republican, but he's managed to pull it off. If you're Eric Paulson in the Minneapolis suburbs, where he just produced an ad and put it on television saying that he will stand up to President Trump and said it by name, I mean, that's where you're going to see these voices. Mitch McConnell is vilified by Democrats, and I understand why. He's the Republican leader for letting Trump run roughshod. But he did not stop the ZTE amendment in the Senate. And he made a point this week of saying that he disagreed with the president's comments, both as in regard to NATO and in regard to Russia. And that doesn't mean he deserves a medal, but I just think we need to look at this through a bit of a nuanced lens, because I don't think, look, this may bother Americans, but I don't think it's fair, in a sense, to expect a majority party to just give up its majority, because otherwise, that's why they think they're there. They think that the fact that they're in the majority is good for the country, even if it's not perfect for the country.
Are they doing this? Are they just very, very, very quickly? Do they talk differently, Republicans, privately and publicly?
Of course. Okay. Oh, without a doubt. They have serious issues with the president's foreign policy, trade policy, the way he conducts himself, the way he speaks on Twitter. Are they more inured to it? Are they more a little bit numb to it? Are they over the shock and awe of it? Sure. They're just kind of used to it, and they don't want it to disrupt their lives every day. But does it bother them? Do they wish that he take the best of him and dispense with the worst of him? 100%, and they'd probably pay money if that's what it took to get it done.
It's just they won't say it publicly yet.
Never.
There we go. All right. David Drucker is a senior political correspondent for the Washington Examiner and a CNN political analyst. David, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
I think that the president should support strongly the national security agencies.
For goodness sakes, pass the bill that will protect the Mueller investigation.
I am the principal sponsor of the legislation that protects the integrity of Mr. Mueller's office.
Pass some bills that will protect our political system from dark money.
I don't know whether it will reach the floor, but I am strongly in support of it.
Particularly the House Republican leadership will not allow any of them to come to a floor for a vote, and that's not going to change unless control of the House changes in November.
One of these guys is a Republican, one a Democrat. Can you tell which is which? No? Maybe that's because they're both campaigning to win a purple suburban district. The first voice was New Jersey Republican Congressman Leonard Lance. The second, his Democratic challenger, Tom Malinowski. For the second half of the show, we'll focus on the fight for the suburbs as part of our ongoing look at different voter groups in the lead-up to the midterm elections. And we begin in New Jersey's 7th District, one of the most competitive races in the country.
The 7th Congressional District is a mostly suburban and rural district.
It's highly educated. It's relatively affluent.
Moderate-leaning district.
It includes suburbs of New York, and it goes all the way to the Pennsylvania border.
It's the only district in New Jersey with a Republican representative that voted for Hillary Clinton.
It's a joy to represent. It is a district where I have lived my entire life.
It's a district full of folks who they're concerned about some of the things that are happening right now. That strike them as crazy and open to an alternative.
Nestled in north central New Jersey, the 7th District encompasses some of the wealthiest areas in the country. The median income in the district, just over $1 million. Over half the residents have either a college or postgraduate degree. Politically, it leans Republican, but not overwhelmingly so. Mitt Romney won the district rather easily, but in 2016, Hillary Clinton narrowly carried the 7th. Lance himself has often broken with the party and the president.
I think that Mitt Romney was a more popular candidate than Donald Trump. I think anyone who knows me knows that my personality is similar to Mitt Romney's.
Let's talk a little about you and how you represent this district versus the way that the district views President Trump. You voted against the Obamacare repeal bill. Correct?
I did.
Yeah, and against the tax bill.
I did.
Which, these are two of the signature issues right now of this Republican Congress. So does this suggest that the Republican agenda is out of step then with voters like yours, with districts like yours?
I vote my conscience, and I believe I vote the views of the district. I voted against the health care bill, the tax bill. I voted for a discharge petition on the immigration issue. I also am a free trader. And regarding Russia, I've been very, very critical of the president in that regard. There are areas where I support the administration. For example, ISIS. I think this administration has done a better job in that situation. I have identified myself as a lifelong Eisenhower Republican. I have an opponent this year who has said that he is a lifelong progressive Democrat.
At the same time, the party is run by a president who certainly would not put himself in the category of Eisenhower. So how do you square that? How do you convince voters that you're an Eisenhower Republican and yet the Republican Party itself has moved much further away from that centrist model?
I think that is true in both political parties, and I see the Democratic Party moving significantly to the left. And regarding the Republican Party, I have been a lifelong Republican and will continue to fight for my beliefs. And I think that Eisenhower Republicanism may very well come back into style, because I think that it is highly likely, I predict, that centrists will have greater influence in the new Congress than is currently the case.
Do you feel lonely in the Republican conference? I hear you talking, and I think when I started covering Congress in the 90s, there were a lot of Republicans that sounded like you. And I feel like there are fewer and fewer of those now.
I am a member of what's known as the Tuesday Lunch Group. We are the moderates on the Republican side, and I don't feel lonely. And I hope that in the new term there might be more. But regardless of that, in the district I serve, I believe this is a race between someone who is a moderate conservative and someone who is a progressive Democrat. Our district is a moderate district. I am convinced that my views are the views of the residents I represent.
My closest partner in the United States Congress over the years has been Senator John McCain. That's the kind of Democrat that I am.
That's Tom Malinowski, Congressman Lance's challenger. While Lance paints his opponent as too far to the left for the district, Malinowski paints Lance as too far right, a calculation that the key to winning their suburban district might just be somewhere in the middle.
Well, I don't really accept he's that independent. If you look at his record over the last 9 years, he has voted in lockstep with the Republican majority about 90% of the time. It was probably 100% before the Trump administration started changing the politics of his district.
Now, Republicans will make the claim that you are going to have to prove that you're not beholden to the more liberal elements of the Democratic Party, and that's going to be hard for you to do.
It's not going to be hard for me as somebody who has spent a lifetime working on international affairs, protecting the national security of our country. My closest partner in the United States Congress over the years has been Senator John McCain. That's the kind of Democrat that I am.
If I were to get in a car and drive around your district, stopping every few miles and interviewing folks, what are the top issues that they would tell me they're concerned about?
I'll tell you what they say to me. Their top issue is the tax bill that the House GOP passed last year, which took away our state and local income tax deductions. It's resulted in property values in the district declining. They're worried about the rising cost of health care, making sure that we protect coverage for pre-existing conditions. And they're worried about protecting kids from gun violence, making sure that our kids are safe. And on all these issues, they just don't see what the Congress is doing for us in the last year and a half. We've seen potential compromise after compromise proposed, never ever seeing the light of day on the floor of the House of Representatives, because the leadership that Congressman Lance supports will not allow that legislation to come to the floor.
How often does President Trump come up in conversation with voters?
It comes up, but I don't have to bring it up. You know, there's a segment of the electorate that is extremely worried about the direction President Trump is taking the country. They still want to know, what am I going to do for them? How am I going to be different from the incumbent? And that's what I focus on. I'm not running against Donald Trump. I am running against the Republican Congress and a representative who I think has failed to deliver for the district or provide checks and balances.
Then candidate Trump, he lost this district, but very, very narrowly. And 4 years earlier, Mitt Romney had carried this district. So is this a district that it's basically a Republican district, but Republican voters who aren't necessarily Trump Republicans? Or is this about the underlying changes happening in this district, that voters here who maybe have voted a Republican for years are no longer identifying themselves with the party?
There's a little bit of that. You know, I would say it's a district full of middle-of-the-road voters who are fiscally responsible, patriotic, and the Republican Party in Washington under President Trump's leadership is none of those things. And so I think there's a lot of anxiety about the direction that our national leadership is taking the country, and a desire for strong, stable, steady, middle-of-the-road leadership on the part of the Congress, and a sense that our representative just has not been strong in the face of all of these changes. And I think that is the reason why I've been doing so well. I'm ahead in the polls right now. It feels like a completely different election for us than anything this district has experienced in the past.
Tom Malinowski, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Back with you on The Takeaway, I'm Amy Walter, and we continue our look at what matters to voters in the suburbs.
Micah Roberts, Jeffersonville, Indiana. The issues that matter to me this November are health care for all, taxes, wealth inequality, and environmental issues, and that's what I'll be looking for when I'm choosing a candidate.
This is Kara in Hawthorne, New Jersey. I'm most concerned with upholding democracy, equality for minorities, immigrants, and women, repairing our international relations, gun control, and de-escalating the police.
Hi, this is Julia from Clayton, California. Oh, geez. I'm going to vote for anything that has to do with higher salaries and wages and lower taxes.
This is Seth Malloy of Justin, Texas. I will be basing my decisions on political morality. Can their goals match reality? Are they based on fact or are they fictional?
So my other job is at the Cook Political Report, and my colleague there analyzes all of the House races in the country. And what he found is of the 34 Republican districts he ranks as the most vulnerable to flipping Democratic, two-thirds are in the suburbs surrounding cities like Minneapolis, Dallas, Seattle, and Chicago. And of course, New Jersey's 7th district, which is outside of New York City. So what do these suburban districts have in common?
Obviously close to a metropolitan area. They are comprised of highly educated voters. This cycle, the ones that are most energized in these suburban districts are college-educated women voters.
That's Liesl Hickey. Liesl's the founding director of Ascent Media and a former executive director of the National Republican Congressional Committee. And what do these suburban voters look for in a candidate for Congress?
People who are thoughtful, they're mostly bipartisan or have acted in a bipartisan way while in office, that they are willing to go against the grain and sometimes go against their own party, that they're very independent. And when you look at typical base voters on either side in these districts, they're a little softer than you would see in other districts across the country that are more partisan. These voters are less partisan behaving, in my opinion.
Liesl hosts the House Talk podcast alongside Allie Lapp, the founder of the House Majority PAC and a former campaign director at the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Allie knows just how crucial the suburbs are for Democrats this November.
Democrats have to do exceptionally well in the suburbs in order to pick up the 23 seats they need to win the majority, for sure. I think Democrats will also pick up some non-suburban seats, some more rural, small-town seats as well. But I certainly think the majority of the seats Democrats will take back will be in the suburbs.
You guys have been doing House races for, I don't know, a million years, maybe. I know it feels like a billion years that we've been following these races. Allie, tell me what feels different when you're looking at these districts today than 2 years ago, 4 years ago.
Suburban voters, in my mind, are trending more Democratic today than they were 2 or 4 years ago.
Is this all about Trump or is there something else going on?
I think it is a lot about Trump. Let me give you an anecdote. We've been talking to some voters in Southern California, and we asked them, what percentage of the time do you think your Republican congressman votes with Donald Trump? And what do you think that percentage should be? And really interestingly, they thought that their member of Congress voted with Trump in the 60s, 60 to 70%. And they wanted him to be voting with Trump. They knew that it was a Republican, so they expected them to be voting with Trump about 50% of the time. The real number was about 97, 98, 99% for these Republican incumbents, and they were really horrified by that. Like, so they think that Congress should be much more independent of the president than it is, and I think they're really turned off by Donald Trump, and so now more than ever, they think their members of Congress should be standing up to him, and they don't see it happening.
So, Liesl, how do you do that? You work with Republicans. You've worked with a lot of Republicans in districts like this where they have shown their independence and they were able to hold on to seats during, the George W. Bush era. But it seems now that showing your independence from Trump is more politically dangerous for Republicans than it was before, or that the idea of sticking with your party and with your tribe is more valuable today to voters than it was 4 or 5 years ago?
Well, I mean, this is always a calculation that people make when they're running. And in these true swing suburban districts, I make the calculation that you take a risk of offending some people who might be with your base, because the largest swath of the electorate and how you actually get a victory in November is to win a bunch of people who currently do not like the president and maybe some of his policies. I agree with Ali that that's the difference in terms of how voters feel and how they see this cycle is mostly based upon their feelings towards the president. Obviously, his approval number in suburban districts is lower than it is in other places in the country. But the thing that remains the same in suburban districts, and I think has consistently, and why Republicans can even hold on in hard times, is because at the heart of it, these voters are also very much economic voters. And in these districts, if you win economic voters, people who say the economy is what's most important to them, that is a path to victory. And that will be the path to victory for many Republicans this cycle. And the economy is performing very well. And people in these suburban districts, I think, feel like their lives are better financially.
I agree that for the suburban voters in particular, everything is seen through a prism of Donald Trump, for sure. But I don't accept the argument that if voters are just voting on economic issues, Republicans are going to win. Because in the research we've done and in talking to some of these suburban voters, they're not happy with the direction Republicans want to go on healthcare, and they are very split on the tax cut. And there is a real argument to make with these voters on fiscal responsibility that I think a lot of the Democrats that are running in this district are going to do. So I don't accept that we, if all voters care about is the economy, and if that's their top issue heading into the voting booth in November, that they automatically pull the lever for a Republican. I think Democrats have a really good case to make on economic issues as well. These are also highly educated, pretty nuanced voters, and we do find that they're very split on who to give credit for the economy to. They know that, you know, Donald Trump only took office a little more than a year ago, so they're like, well, Obama deserves some credit too, but it's also, this is just the fiscal cycle, this is how things go. Like, they're not willing to just say, yes, Republicans are always better for the economy.
Lisa, what are you saying to Republican candidates who are in these suburban districts that's different from what you were telling them in 06 or 10 or 12 or 14? Or is it still the same message?
I mean, a lot of it's the same. I think part of the difference this cycle is in 06, voters had a real problem with a lot of the policies of President Bush. And mostly that was around the Iraq War, obviously. And this cycle, most of the problems center around the president himself, how they see his character and the way he behaves, and not as much around the actual policies.
And that's what's interesting, Ali, because I agree with Liesl's point that it seems to be so much more personality focused than policy focused. And yet when I meet Democratic candidates and I watch Democratic ads, they don't talk about Donald Trump. They don't talk about his personality. They talk about health care or the tax bill or some other issue. So how much of the race is going to be determined by personality versus the issues?
Well, Democrats don't need to talk about Donald Trump's personality because, as I like to say, the Trump circus is happening. It is happening around us every day and everyone knows it. And I think that there are plenty of Donald Trump's policies that are pretty unpopular, from pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord to the tariffs, I think have some real potential for some opposition. Even, you know, their crown jewel, the tax cut, is very mixed. I mean, it's pretty split evenly. Healthcare is a problem for them. Bush had Katrina. Donald Trump has Puerto Rico. You know, there's a lot of corruption issues and misuse of taxpayer dollars that I think are problems for people in the suburbs. So I think Democrats are running on a policy agenda. And I think, again, the personality of Donald Trump is the backdrop for everything. But they know that that has only opened the door for a Democrat to walk through. And they need to prove themselves in order to walk through that door and actually get elected.
Liesl, if this were President Jeb Bush or President Mitt Romney right now, would we be talking about the suburban vote as being so critical in this election that these would be real swing districts?
Well, I mean, I think we'd still be talking about it. I don't know if we'd be seeing the enthusiasm that we're seeing, not just amongst traditional Democratic voters in these districts, but amongst college-educated women who have really either been independents, or a lot of them in these suburban districts have been soft Republicans or establishment Republicans or whatever sort of, you know, definition you want to give them. So I think if we would have had it maybe a different president, we wouldn't have the situation that we are currently in with those voters.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's 25 districts that Republicans hold that Hillary Clinton won. Most of those are in the suburbs. If I just look at a list of those right now, I would say, you know, maybe there's five or six that if it were Romney or Jeb Bush, Hillary wouldn't have won. You know, particularly Orange County, Texas suburbs, maybe some of those. And then you go look at the list of districts that Obama won, that that Trump won, and there's probably some of those Hillary might have carried against a less populist Republican, right? So maybe some of those would have shifted grounds. But I do think the suburbs have been the battleground for a long time and will continue to be. And you asked earlier, Amy, is it just Donald Trump that's driving them to be more Democratic, in my view? And I think that's part of it. But I do think that there are some other issues at play as well. I think that there's an increasing split in college-educated voters and non-college-educated voters. And college-educated are becoming more and more Democratic, and they tend to be in some of these higher-income suburbs. I think there's also issues like guns and immigration and sort of tolerance and diversity, where some of these voters just don't see Republicans aligning with them anymore, and so they're open to voting for a moderate, but a Democrat nonetheless.
So do you think then that it's fair to say that cultural rather than economic issues are the driving force in these districts?
I still think economic issues are the driving force. And culturally, I think where the debate used to be in these suburban districts has shifted a lot. And I think the debate now is more focused around immigration and issues around tolerance and those types of character integrity type issues, and less so about the traditional issues we used to talk about,
like
abortion, gay marriage, things like that. We've sort of moved on from those debates in these districts. So the issue set is different. I mean, I would add the environment and climate change in there as well.
I totally agree. We've seen in some of our research that protecting national parks and the environment was like the number one issue that these voters wanted their Republican congressman to stand up to Trump on. I never would have predicted that.
Right.
I thought that was really interesting.
It also seems, Allie, that the issue of guns, something that Democrats have really shied away from in the past, making a top tier issue. The fear was that there are more engaged pro-Second Amendment people than there are really passionate, you know, gun control voters, that that's changed, that we may see, I don't know, I'm curious your take, that the issue of guns and gun safety becomes a top issue in these districts in a way we haven't seen before.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out in the general. I mean, definitely Democrats have been talking about it in some primaries to sort of differentiate themselves against their opponents.
One put mace in his face to talk about it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Who is this?
There was a candidate for Congress in a Colorado congressional district in a Democratic primary who, to make a case on guns, actually sprayed mace in his own face, trying to make the point that mace was a safer way to protect schools than guns. So
it looked very painful
way to make a point, right?
He lost.
Yes, he did. He did lose. But I think on a lot of these cultural issues like guns, like immigration, like abortion in the suburbs, I always say the candidate that brings up the issue and that's screaming the loudest about them often turns those voters off. They're looking for moderation on these issues more than anything. And I think that, you know, in the past, Republicans have been able to kind of paint Democrats as, you know, wanting to take everyone's gun away and licensing and things that just sounded so extreme. And I think that for a lot of these suburban voters, they now think Republicans are too extreme on guns, that they're not open to common sense safety precautions and measures. And I think that definitely benefits Democrats in these districts.
And not all the suburban, obviously, districts are the same. And culturally, they are different because they're in different parts of the country. So you might have ones in certain parts of the country where guns are, you know, seen very differently than other parts in the country. Maybe in some of the Texas suburban districts, I mean, they're obviously viewed very differently than you might see in the Northeast. But I will say one thing that I think is common amongst all of the districts is they're wanting common sense solutions. You hear this over and over. They want people to work across the aisle, get things done. They want people to come together, stop the dysfunction that they see happening in Washington. So as these races play out, I think it'll be really interesting as the Democrats want to try to keep up their enthusiasm with their base. And most of them are pretty serious about wanting to impeach the president, and they also are resisting him in some sort of way. And then how does that translate, though, into coming to Washington and actually working across the aisle, getting things done?
Well, that does seem to be the central sort of friction point, which is if you're just watching the national news, all you see is chaos and controversy and people not getting along and dysfunction. So can you make a case that breaks through that says, oh, I can come to Washington and bridge that gap? Or is that even a believable argument, do you think?
You have to actually have evidence to show that that is something you've been doing. And luckily, Republican incumbents sitting in these toughest districts are able to have a story and a narrative to tell that shows how they've worked in a bipartisan manner, how they're trying to get things done. They can point to pieces of legislation. They can point to their bipartisan index score.
Well, and a lot of them do have a good story to tell. I mean, Will Hurd has the great, you know, road trip across Texas.
Right.
And but I think back to back in the olden days, Amy, my favorite Republican, Chris Shays, who did survive that 2006 wave. He was just a very moderate Republican from Connecticut, but in 2008 just couldn't weather it anymore. And he had done everything as much as he could bipartisan, right? Very bipartisan, very moderate member. But I think ultimately the voters in that district just said, we're interested in Democrats right now. And look, Democrats faced the same problem in countless districts in 2010 where, you know, you had Democrats running on, I voted against Obamacare, I voted against all the environmental legislation. And ultimately voters said, yeah, we just want Republicans right now. And so I think the challenge for some of these Republicans who have tried to work across the aisle is voters may say, you might be trying, but your party's not. And your party's not holding this president accountable. And so we're going to have to put someone else in charge.
And that's been a trend, right? I mean, I remember talking to a Democratic pollster in 2010 who said, you know, you'd go in and you'd ask voters, what do you think about this Democratic incumbent? Oh, I like him. Are you going to vote for him? No.
Yeah.
You know, because I hate Obama. So I need to tell Obama why I don't like what he's doing. And it seems to me then that we, once again, the hollowing out of the center, if Democrats do take control of Congress, it will be because they defeated the very people who want to be more bipartisan.
Right. And they retired. And a lot of them retired.
A lot of them retired.
So if we think to 2019, regardless of who controls Congress, is the assumption that it's going to be even more polarized?
I think it's hard not to see that. I will say the light at the end of the tunnel, hopefully, is, you know, despite some of the press that some of the Democratic nominees are getting, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who defeated Joe Crowley, for example, I think most of the vast majority of Democrats winning their primaries are really winning on a, you know, I want to get stuff done agenda. And Nancy Pelosi, as much as she is demonized, you know, she will be the next Speaker of the House because she gets things done in her party and her caucus knows that. So I think that there is a desire with this new fresh blood of Democratic freshmen that are going to be coming in to get things done. And they are not going to be interested in just political posturing.
After the 2016 elections, the media spotlight was focused almost exclusively on small town and rural America. Specifically, the regions that once supported Democrats, but then overwhelmingly voted for Donald Trump. It seemed almost every media outlet in America had to find a voter who supported Obama in 2012, but flipped to Trump in 2016. But guess what? It's not 2016 anymore. And in 2018, the battleground is different. This year, the race for control of the House goes through suburban America. These places once voted consistently Republican, but they've been drifting away from their GOP roots in recent years. And in 2016, many of these suburban voters supported Hillary Clinton. In fact, for the first time since 1936, a Democratic candidate for president carried Orange County, California, a longtime bastion of conservatism in the state. Look, in every election, every vote matters, and all voters are important. But if you want to see who controls the political fate of the House, you might want to drive out to your local suburban shopping center and check out what these voters are thinking. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Amy Walter. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo. Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.